This is Scott Becker with Becker Group Business Leadership. Thrilled today to have Jeff Cockrell joining us for a webinar. Jeff is the head of private equity at McGuire Woods. He's built a magnificent practice. He's sought after by some of the largest and most successful private equity funds in the world for his advice. He's going to share with us today insight on what's happening in the world of private equity. We've got about 7 to 8 questions for Jeff. We'll also encourage our audience at any time to type in a question, or if it's easier for you to text Scott Becker a question at 312-399-0774. Thank you very much. Jeff, the world of private equity, can you take a moment to introduce yourself?
Yeah, thank you, Scott. It's a real pleasure to be joining you again. We've been partners for a long time. And as you noted, I'm the head of our private equity group at McGuire Woods. There's maybe 50 or 60 folks in my group where we represent private equity funds kind of up and down the capital stack in all sorts of transactions and all sorts of companies and all sorts of sectors. Kind of within that more generally, I spend most of my time representing private equity funds in healthcare transactions.
Well, thank you, Jeff. And take a moment. And it's been a very interesting period of time for private equity after a huge growth period over the last several years. What's currently happening in the private equity world? What are 3 or so of the most interesting issues that you see as it relates to private equity?
It's been quite a whirlwind. The first few months of this pandemic, when everything kind of shut down, all eyes in the private equity world were kind of down on their portfolios, kind of dealing with very urgent problems, furloughing people, navigating federal programs, renegotiating provisions and relationships with lenders, with landlords, with key employees, all of these measures to try and preserve enough cash to stay afloat for a period of unknown duration. So for a while, everything was kind of all hands on deck, dealing with very urgent problems. I'm a M&A lawyer by trade. And so against that backdrop, there were still a lot of deals that had gotten pretty far down the road. Many of them kind of went pencils down. Some of them kept going. And just now are folks starting to come out of the other side of that kind of really, really intense turmoil and starting to look more at kind of acquisitions and add-on acquisitions or new platform acquisitions. So that is just starting to come back online. So that's been very interesting to kind of be in the middle of. It's been very interesting also navigating more kind of pointed distress situations, whether that's on the company side or on the acquirer side, which, as you can imagine, many private equity funds, while they have problems in many parts of their portfolio, are also very interested in being a buyer if someone is needing to be a forced seller. So kind of watching those processes come about reminds me of the opening line of one of Ernest Hemingway's books, where a guy was asking another guy, how'd your company go bankrupt? And he said, 2 ways, very gradually and then very suddenly. And that's very true. Companies that were kind of doing well, they certainly feel distress in the midst of all this, but for companies that were doing not well, the distress comes hard and fast and things happen very quickly. So that's been an exciting and difficult pathway to navigate as well.
So the concept of, I love this concept of very gradually and very suddenly. Certainly a lot of companies in the retail sector that have invested in private equity were sort of very gradually struggling, but then very suddenly have really struggled. What else are you seeing in different sectors that you see throughout the private equity environment? Are you seeing some sectors be stronger than others? I know certainly energy has been a debacle, retail has been a debacle. Are there areas that are doing better?
For sure. I mean, there are certain sectors where the the things that those companies do or provide are all of a sudden in high demand, but those have been fewer and further between. And I'd say there's kind of two kinds of strain that it puts on companies. One is kind of the general burden of a very quickly, sharply turning south general economy, where much like rising tide lifts all boats, the tide going out pushes them all down in very challenging ways. And then there are companies where the specific nature of the pandemic puts altogether different and urgent pressures on them. If you're an airline or a hotel, or I spend a lot of time in healthcare provider services, so if all of a sudden your clinic is shut down and there's zero revenue coming in, that's a challenge of an altogether different type. So it varies dramatically by the nature of the business that you undertake.
Thank you. And what is the, in terms of mergers and acquisitions, give us a sense of the timetable for M&A to really get started again. You said before it's starting to peak up a little bit again. What's your sense of the M&A environment over the next 2 to 12 months or so?
Early on, it seemed like, in kind of my conversations with investment banker friends, was that one of the gating items of whether or not a deal was going to really advance is how far it had gotten before everything shut down. And in particular, were they able to do some of the in-person meetings that are necessary for diligence and just general comfort level with the person that is in the group that is going to be your partner, and where you couldn't have those kind of in-person, really get to know somebody connections, those processes were harder to get started. But those have picked up again. So I would say the phase where that was the gating item has kind of come and gone. And now it's much more mixed with some, and I'd say it's kind of philosophical and temperament driven as much as anything, with some private equity funds having one kind of an appetite to be a buyer in this environment, and other funds just generally not having an appetite for the risk that comes with that sort of uncertainty. And even if someone does want to do a transaction, there are altogether new challenges that get introduced that aren't a part of the sequence normally. For example, normally you'd be pricing a business on some form of valuation keyed to the trailing 12 months cash flow or EBITDA that the company throws off. When you interject a sharp downturn for 3 months, it becomes very difficult to apply those same sort of valuation metrics. You can kind of navigate some of your way through that with kind of earnouts and other contingent payments if you can. In my healthcare world, sometimes you can do that, sometimes you can't. But regardless, there's much more of a possibility for there to be very divergent views of how to price the risk of coming out of this pandemic into a purchase price for a company. So there are lots of challenges that make pricing the deal difficult. There's also challenges of does a buyer, are they really ready to be the owner of a business that is still in a significant measure of turmoil? For a while, like in the healthcare world, the idea of acquiring, for example, an ophthalmology practice when all of the doctors are home is not exactly what you want as a buyer. So lining up the timing to when the business is up and running as kind of a first measure and up and running at a level that is consistent with prior activity is an altogether different one, but all those things push back the timing.
Is there a bigger delta in pricing because buyers, private equity funds, their portfolio companies want a deal and sellers aren't quite ready to make a deal based on a potential normal of EBITDA and what earnings look like? Is there a big delta?
There's a, the difference in expectation of pricing that comeback risk can be profound. There's also some kind of pricing realities that are starting to, that are going to be continuing to evolve of credit markets for funding these deals have been choppier. They haven't, they didn't go away like they did in 2008, but they've been choppier and more expensive and more expensive debt coupled with maybe fewer turns of leverage available has a necessary kind of impact on pricing of deals. So you've got a number of factors that can create a disconnect in the expectations of buyers and sellers. The sellers have a difficult time getting the world 6 months ago out of their head. The buyers have a difficult time getting the world of now and 6 months from now in their head. And it just, there's a lot of room for mismatched expectations. There's tools you can do to try to bridge some of those things, but they can be a challenge.
And take a moment on the lending environment. You started to touch on that. We just saw that J.P. Morgan just reserved another $10.5 billion in loan loss reserves. What does the lending environment look like for the core investors into private equity? Some of those are very closely tied to private equity funds. Some are independent of private equity funds. But what does the lending environment look like?
Yeah, we deal with kind of two broad types of lenders. Lenders that are kind of in their DNA deposit banks, like so regular banks. And then a whole cadre of non-bank senior lenders that are kind of like debt private equity funds. They have different sources of capital, but they provide the senior debt financing for private equity backed companies. And I would say in both of those arenas, it's been a little mixed. Some of the lenders on the depository side have been very good in dealing with borrowers who are either have or about to report missing financial covenants, kind of working with them as opposed to tightening the screws. There's a lot of ways to tighten the screws. We've seen some lenders repricing the overall debt. So some have done that, some have not. Also with respect to availability of credit, there's been a disparity of responses. Some lenders have said we're not repricing your deal. We're not going to be difficult with you, but we're probably not kind of open for business for more borrowing under this credit facility for a while. Whereas others have been both on the traditional lender and the kind of the fund lender have been much more open for business. But in all of them, I would say the biggest variable of when things have gone well and access to additional credit, but the biggest variable has been the closeness of the core underlying relationship. So a private equity fund that has a relationship with a lender that may cover across a whole series of platform companies, their relationship, their kind of treatment when things are a little bit sideways, their access to additional capital is going to be often better than much thinner relationships.
Another question, private equity funds, through whatever fund they're in, have a cadre of portfolio companies that they have invested in. What are you seeing with the portfolio companies? How is that sorting itself out?
Like as far as performance?
Yes, performance, panic, is it going okay? What are you seeing sort of out there? What are you hearing from private equity funds in terms of the situations with their portfolio companies? How much are the private equity investors and the leaders there panicked versus confident that their portfolio companies will be okay? How many are overextended? What's the general gestalt sense that you get out there about how portfolio companies are doing?
I think more resilient than I would have thought 2 months ago. For companies that are underlying good businesses, I think everyone in that business and their relationships kind of see this as a temporary spot and they can see far enough ahead to where they expect things to be okay. And whether this is the landlord for a multi-site healthcare company or the lender or key executives, it's still a company that when this situation ends, they still want to have as a tenant, as a borrower, as the place where they work. And when you can kind of see down the road far enough and recognize that you have a basically good company, it's a lot easier to weather the storms. It's a lot easier to get concessions from the participants. But kind of going back to what we were talking about before, if this episode is an accelerant of an underlying kind of deeper malaise, then it gets much choppier, much more quickly, and the value that people talk about, these companies can dramatically change. And once that happens, then the world kind of pivots because you have a private equity fund that now at the theoretical value of the company, they may be completely underwater. And now you're looking, and the real value is in the hands of the lenders. And again, depending on how out of the money they are, they may be interested in kind of helping to salvage this business, or if they're badly out of the money, or if it's a kind of a cadre of lenders instead of one lender, there may not be anyone with the real interest in carrying this burden. All of a sudden, the nature of transactions that people are starting to talk about and the severity of those transactions can turn on a dime. But in my mind, it's a line of one of my restructuring partners says that most distressed companies earn the right to be there. And it's the companies where there's an underlying negative trend that has been significantly accelerated, where it's harder to see the pathway out on the other side.
Thank you. And private equity funds, a couple points, are famously sitting on trillions of dollars to invest. They also typically don't get their management fee itself until that money's been invested. Our fund's still raising money currently, whereas a lot of that activity been put on hold. Is there a little slow to put that money to work?
They certainly are in the kind of fundraising cycles. Can be kind of long for a fund that starts and will go for a significant period of time. And many of them were in that process before this happened. Others are starting it now. There's certainly some headwinds with respect to kind of larger institutional investors that can come from a couple sources. One is larger investors, I don't think have or ever will lose their faith in the asset class of private equity as a place to achieve kind of outsized returns against the market, but they have kind of allocation disciplines of how much of their portfolio they really want to be in this asset class. And when the public market goes down as it has, you have kind of a denominator effect of if you wanted 5 or 7% in kind of this class of an asset, when your denominator shrinks, you may be over allocated and not having a desire to allocate more. Kind of secondarily, there's a cash flow question of significant investors. Institutional investors, they are cycling their portfolio, and as they're getting distributions from one source, that becomes the source of funding capital commitments into another round of that class of investment. And if distributions are slowed as they have been, there's an additional reluctance to kind of bite off additional commitments when the sourcing and funding of those, at least in part, was intended to be coming from kind of returns of capital from the last go around. And all those things can create some headwinds. There is still, those dynamics aren't present with every institutional investor, and they still are looking to deploy capital one way or the other. So there will still be fundraising for sure, and there'll be a lot of people that are successful in raising funds, this does create some incremental headwinds that'll make that harder.
Thank you. And Jeff, you've become on a national level really the guru of private equity, particularly in the healthcare sector. Tremendous mix of analytical skills and personal and leadership skills that have led you in that direction, together with tremendous focus. Talk to us for a moment about what's happening in the world of healthcare private equity. Are people continuing to buy these provider platforms? Are they over-leveraged? Is there going to be a blow-up of them like there was 20 years ago in the provider sort of practice management platforms? What are you seeing in healthcare private equity?
That's a multifaceted, complex question, and there's a lot of things kind of going on at the same time. Whenever there's a downturn, it doesn't, as just kind of a first basis, it doesn't mean that now is not the time to be buying something. It may mean that the thing that was purchased 2 years ago at a very robust valuation, even if it's grown and done well, is probably is worth less than it would have been if things hadn't gone a bit sideways. So there's still value to be achieved. And to me, some of the kind of really, really heady valuations out there of 14, 15, 16 times have built into that valuation is kind of an unambiguous need to just continue doing rapid fire acquisitions to bring that number down. And that I'm not sure that was ever a super healthy pathway. And more pointedly, I think some of the companies that have had trouble where the trouble has sometimes arisen is doing a number of acquisitions where more time is needed to really kind of congeal that into a more cohesive business, build kind of system-wide controls and procedures and culture. And I would say the investors that have done well in the midst of this are those where that activity of kind of building a business as opposed to closing acquisitions, those that have been skilled at building a unified business are doing well in the midst of this and are going to do well and are going to continue to create value. And the idea of just doing rapid fire acquisitions is probably not an option that's available anymore. And the upmarket buyers are increasingly more attuned to expecting that to see a unified business and a track record of bringing these add-on acquisitions in and together and unifying them before you're going to achieve some of those higher valuations. So a little bit more discipline around investing, I think, is going to be a good thing. There's certainly a lot of room for there to be kind of another round of immense turmoil if states shut down elective procedures. And I always, whenever I hear elective procedures, it's not elective like you're going to maybe get a hamburger. It's elective like a hip replacement. They're things that need to happen. But if there's another round of shutting all those things down, it could be damaging in a way that has much higher orders of magnitude. So a lot of different cross currents running through healthcare investing. But what I'd say kind of more generally is that there's still very much an appetite and a expectation on the part of investors that they can identify things of value that they can build and create value for their platform company. And I don't see that ending anytime soon.
Well, fantastic, Jeff. You've built a remarkable practice, a remarkable following and knowledge base in the private equity space and built a great group. We appreciate you so much spending some time today sharing with us thoughts on the world of private equity. We'll wrap up at this point. We'll get this distributed shortly. We greatly appreciate your insights and thoughts today, Jeff. Thank you very much.
Anytime. Thanks a lot, Scott.